Good evening, everybody. Thank you all for coming out on this beautiful spring, still spring evening. I wanted to talk today about a koan that just seemed to come up for me in the last few days. And, you know, it's funny how the koan practice and the work goes after you've been working on it for some time. Sometimes an old koan might pop up for you for whatever reason, and that's part of the process of it. Also, they keep coming back over and over and over again. And this koan itself is very short, and then there's a story attached to it, a story which I think some of you know. So the koan goes like this. The koan goes, Gosho asked the monk, Seijo and her soul are separated. Which one is the true Seijo? Now, this is one of those koans that I was hearing when I first started coming around the Zendo a long, long time ago. There's even a recording somewhere of Roshi giving a talk on it from like 15 years ago. But so this is one of those koans where it is probably best to know the background of who this Seijo was and what the story is all about. So the story goes that Seijo was a young woman who grew up in a small village in China. And the players in this story are her father, Chokan, and her cousin, Ochu. And so Seijo and Ochu grew up together. They were around the same age, and they were very close. And everyone always thought that they would end up together and married. They seemed like they loved each other so much when they were little kids that everybody thought that would happen. And so the time came when she was becoming of age to be married, and her father told her that he had actually worked something out, and he was going to have her marry someone else. He was having, he worked out some kind of political thing, and there was another man that was going to be coming to the village that she was going to marry. And her and Ochu were, in fact, very deeply in love. And when she heard this, it was very distressing for her. And when Ochu heard this, it was kind of unbearable for him. And so he decided that in the middle of the night, he was just going to split. He was just going to take off. So that night finally came, and he got in his boat. I think they were in a little town that was on a river. So he got in his boat on the river and started rowing away. And he noticed this silhouette on the shore that seemed to be following him. And he stopped and he called out to see who it was. And sure enough, it was Seijo. She had followed him. And she said something along the lines that she couldn't live without him, and that wherever he was going, she wanted to go with him. So they get in the boat, and they travel for some time, and they end up in another village far away, and they get married, and they have two children, and a couple years pass, 5 years pass. And after the 5 years, they have their two, I believe, daughters. And Seijo, she always feels like there's something missing for her. And at some point, her and Ochu speak, and he feels the same. And they both realize that they're feeling very homesick, and they're feeling very guilty for leaving their families, and they want to go back and face the music. So they decide to finally do it, and they get in the boat, and they go back. And when they get to the port, Ochu says, why don't you wait here with the children? I'll go talk to Chokan. I'll go talk to your father and try and straighten this out. So he goes up and sees Chokan. And Chokan is so happy to see him. He hasn't seen him in 5 years. He's like, oh, it's so wonderful to see you. We didn't know where you went. And Ochu, you know, after the greeting, he goes into his story and he tells him what him and Seijo did, and that, you know, it was true love, and that they needed to be together, and they were very sorry, and they wanted to come back, and were seeing if they could rejoin the community in the village. And Chokan is very, very confused when he's hearing this story. He's like, Ochu, I don't know what you're talking about. Seiju is up lying in her bed, and she's been lying up there ever since you left. Ever since you left, she kind of became very distant. She hasn't even spoken a word. She's just been lying in bed for 5 years. So, as you can imagine, this is quite shocking news for Ochu, who assures him that Seijo is in the boat down at the dock, and their two children are in it. And he asks Chokan if he would like to go see them, and Chokan says no, but he sends an attendant to go check. And he asks Ochu if he would like to come upstairs and see Seijo. And they go upstairs, and sure enough, Seijo is there lying in the bed. And at that moment, the attendant returns back and lets Chokan know that he actually did see Seijo in the boat with the two children. And the Seijo that's lying in the bed, upon hearing this, gets up. And I guess from the story, from seeing the attendant, the Seijo from the boat get up, and they start walking, and at a certain moment they see each other, and they keep walking, and they keep walking until they walk into each other and they become one. And there's a little bit more to the story. Speaking, Seijo speaks to her father and says, I never even realized that I was here. It was as if I was in a dream. She says some things like that. The whole point is that these two parts of Seijo come together and become one. So Seijo and her soul are separated. Which one is the true Seijo? So this koan, like I said, has been coming up for me a lot as I relate it to my life. And it's one of those kind of memorable stories that actually pops up for me quite often. And I believe what the koan is pointing at is asking us if we really know ourselves. Who is the real you? What is that? Who is that? And so in my looking at it, I felt like this story kind of, illustrates what happens internally to us when we experience something traumatic or difficult or just life-altering, right? The event happens, whatever the event is, and then there's some kind of split, just like what happened to Seijo. On one hand, we are frozen, kind of lying motionless in our fear and grief. And on the other hand, we run away in fantasies. We want to run away in our minds, playing out situations that are fairy tale-like, in ways that offer momentary relief from the trauma. And we create this narrative of the way we think things ought to be. And I think that in some ways that frozen part of us, which I relate to very much, is like an injured or scared animal. Kind of a cornered or injured animal. And you know that an injured animal can be very dangerous. An injured animal has the potential to be very aggressive and attack irrationally, to do whatever it can to survive. I often notice this in little ways when I find myself just walking around the street and getting mad at somebody who just is all of a sudden in the trajectory of where I want to walk or something like, you know, or if I'm riding a bike and somebody, if I'm riding a city bike and somebody's on the bike path or, you know, just little things like that, I notice anger come up. And at that moment, sometimes I can just stop and ask myself, why am I angry? Why am I angry? Is this person really in my way? And what is underneath that anger? Because I don't think it's really possible that you could be angry at someone that you don't know, right? Who didn't even see you. But we take it as a personal offense. So when I think of the quality of what happens when I run away in a fantasy, if I can look at it objectively, I feel like it's an attempt or a hope that the future I am creating in my mind will nullify all that has put me in that frozen place. All the regret, the fear, the sadness, all the voices telling me that I'm not good for nothing, that I'm a failure, that I'm unworthy. This seems to be a way out, in a sense, a way that we can avoid all of it, a way that we can bypass the sadness. I think it's an unconscious thing, but I think that's what is happening with that anger sometimes. So in those moments, it's easy to put the blame on someone else. In that frozen part of you where there's the parts of you that are saying you're good for nothing or whatever. It's easy to find in those moments, it's not my fault, it's your fault. If this person just gets out of my fucking way. And in some ways, it's I think that's also how people can sometimes pick on someone that is like much weaker than them or much smaller than them. It's a very easy way to come out on top. Right? In your mind, you're thinking about all the ways that you fail, that you're sad, or that somewhere inside you has that. But this time, I'll come out on top. Get the hell out of my way, you little kid, or whatever it is. And it happens in very subtle little ways like that, but sometimes not so subtle. So I was walking along the street a couple weeks ago with a friend, and we were just walking, and I didn't even notice anything had happened. Until I noticed my friend was, for just a moment, was a little confused. And then the next thing I knew, this guy that had passed us started screaming at us, started screaming these profanities at us, and was coming at me like with his fists. He was serious. He was ready for a physical confrontation. He was calling me names, and he was like, come on. And luckily my just instinct reaction was to go like this, like, hey, there's nothing wrong here, nothing going on. And putting my hands up like that did luckily diffuse the situation. I found out afterwards, my friend had seen that this guy had passed us and flicked a cigarette at us. But just as chance would happen, it went in between us and it didn't hit us. And so I think he was looking for trouble, obviously. Like he wanted to fight. He wanted to hit me. I mean, it was obvious. He was coming at me. So luckily for me, I didn't even notice that he through the cigarette. So I was like, what? I don't even know. But that also really made me think about what I'm talking about. Think about how separate this guy was from his soul at that moment, that he was ready to attack me and my friend. But I feel like every time there is senseless violence in action or even in your thought, there's a separation from the soul. So every moment of our lives is kind of this potential. Every moment of our lives, there's this potential for this split and for this coming together, being one with your soul again. In Mumon's commentary, he says, if you realize the true one in this, you will understand that getting out of one shell and entering another is just like a traveler staying at an inn. If you have not realized it, don't rush about wildly. That second line is the one that sticks out for me the most right now. If you have not realized it, don't rush about wildly. And that for me speaks to how our practice and what we do here is a means to continually work on finding that way, bringing our soul together. So Menzan Zenji, a teacher from the 18th century who wrote many works, wrote, when, through practice, you know the reality of Zazen thoroughly, the frozen blockage of emotion thought will naturally melt away. If you think you have cut off illusory thought, instead of clarifying how emotion thought melts, the emotion thought will come up again as though you have cut the stem off a blade of grass or the trunk of a tree and left the roots alive. Emotion thought is the root of delusion, a stubborn attachment to a one-sided point of view formed by our own conditioned perceptions. I imagine that we could all understand what that means, right? I mean, an emotion thought, how many times have we been thinking about something and we could feel our temperature rise? Thinking about something, we could feel our heartbeat get faster just from thinking about something that has a strong emotional attachment to it. And I think that there are further physical manifestations that these emotion thoughts can come up in our bodies. And they are actually in our bodies. I feel like this is something that is actually within, physically in our body somewhere. And when we experience certain things that stimulate them, they come up in physical ways. I just wanted to briefly mention about this man who just passed away about 6 weeks ago, named Eugene Gendlin, who did a whole study of in the 50s. He did a comprehensive study of witnessing different people in therapy environments, working with their therapists, and what he found through all his work, and he wrote a book about it, and there's a whole center of it now called the Focusing Institute. And what he discovered was that the people who had positive results through therapy, it had absolutely nothing to do with the type of therapy. with the therapist and, or with the way the therapist approached the patient. It all had, it all 100% had to do with the patient's ability to identify and access these physical manifestations that come up in their body. The way that it was the patients that just had an innate sense, or you know, they just instinctually would go to these feelings in their body, and they would speak through them, not of them, not through the mind, but actually through the body. And I also experienced this as a musician and also as a piano teacher. My old piano teacher used to say that you can't get to the center from the periphery, so the periphery being the fingers. It's always the other way around. She would say, like, the tail can't wag the dog, for instance, right? So the fingers are the periphery, but the center of your being is what controls the periphery, not the other way around. So if a student comes to me and starts speaking about tension that they're feeling in their wrists or in their fingers or in their hands or even in their shoulders or arms, I ask them, do you ever experience tension in your belly when you play the piano? And almost 100% of the time, yes, I always experience that, you know? So the focus is on the wrong place if you're focusing on the fingers in this way. The focus should be on the belly. So if the belly is tight, it's the same thing as cutting off just the tip of that blade of grass, right? If you focus on the fingers over and over again, it's eventually going to come back because we're not going to the center of where the issue is. And that tightness that we feel in the belly, I relate to the sage that's lying in bed frozen, right? So that tightness is holding you there, freezing you, not allowing you to become one with your soul. So what can we do? The great modern Zen teacher, Charlotte Joko Beck, who just passed away in 2011, writes in her book, Everyday Zen, always we must practice getting closer and closer to our experiencing our pain, our disappointment, our shattered hopes, our broken pictures. And that experience is ultimately nonverbal. We must observe the thought content until it is neutral enough that we can enter the direct and nonverbal experience of the disappointment and suffering. When we experience the suffering directly, the melting of the false emotion can begin and true compassion can emerge. I feel like this is what is illustrated in the story when Seiju and Ocho both admit that they are not happy, that they have heartache, that they have homesickness. When they're able to actually admit that and see what their suffering was, getting closer to experiencing their pain, disappointment, shattered hopes, when they were able to do that, they were ready to go back and face the frozen Seijo lying in her bed. Or we could say face that tight belly. What's that really coming from? Face our sorrows. For most of us, as it was for me, when at a certain point in your life, this can all get so unbalanced, just as it did for Seijo and Ochu, that the pain or the sorrow or whatever spills over. And you're like, all right, this is the big elephant in the room of my life. I'm going to do something about it now. And that's a lot of the times how we come into practice. When we can look squarely into the face of our suffering and own it, then we can begin to walk the road of reconnecting our soul. As Enkyo Roshi says here, when we realize the self, we serve the whole world. And we have to remember Mumon's words also, to not rush about wildly. That to me means sit down, put your butt on the cushion, and sit through it. Just sit. Now, in concluding, I just wanted to just kind of offer this perspective because I saw it in in one of the commentaries that I read on this koan about how this story was about a young woman who was basically, in a sense, owned by her father and then went and was owned by her husband, right? So it's not a very modern story for these times. And as I was thinking about that, for some reason, this old Woody Allen movie came up for me called Alice. I don't know if any of you have ever seen that movie. But in that movie, Alice, who was played by Mia Farrow, she kind of goes through a little bit of the same quandary. You know, she's really split from who she wants to be, and she ends up going to see this Chinese herbalist doctor in the village in Soho, who ends up giving her, it's a very funny movie also, and I won't go into the details, but she has a very disappointing relationship with her husband, and then she ends up also falling in love with this other guy, so she's kind of getting pulled in the two directions. But in the movie, what ends up happening to her is that she drops them both. And she goes to India, and she works with Mother Teresa, and she finds herself that way. So just wanted to put that out there, that there is kind of a feminist, kind of anti-feminist kind of situation happening in this story. And it doesn't always have to be either or. And I think that these splits that happen in our life actually happen all the time, and it's not just black and white, and it's not just one and the other. I think it's multitudes and multitudes, sometimes more, sometimes less, but there's all kinds of ways that we split and separate from our own lives, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to get married or make things right with your parents, but it actually has to do with making things right with you. And so if we could look at these stories as ways of seeing our own lives, which is what I believe these koans are all about, they're actually ways for us to see our own lives, then we can use them in ways to help ourselves and ultimately help each other in the world. Thank you.